It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. President Joe Biden touched down in Milwaukee yesterday, praising his administration's efforts to replace lead pipes around the country through the bipartisan infrastructure law and setting a deadline for this work.
I'm announcing a new rule written into law from the Environmental Protection Agency that requires water systems across America replace lead pipe service in every single one in America within 10 years. Must be done.
To help communities comply with the new rule, Biden announced the EPA will make available an additional $2.6 billion in funding for drinking water upgrades and lead pipe replacements, with Wisconsin receiving $43 million of those funds.
To learn more about these efforts in Wisconsin, we turn to Steve Elmore, director of the Bureau of Drinking Water and Groundwater at the Department of Natural Resources. Steve, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. 10 years to no lead service lines. Is this timeline doable for Wisconsin?
I think it is. I mean, we'll have to definitely support utilities around Wisconsin with funding and processes to help them replace them. We know we have about 200,000 lead service lines in Wisconsin currently, and that inventory is getting better every day. There's a new inventory requirement, and we should know better after the 16th of this month exactly how many lead service lines there are in Wisconsin.
Why the 16th?
The previous revisions to the lead and copper rule required an inventory of all service line materials in the state and nationally, and so we'll get all those inventories from the systems by the 16th of this month.
And Milwaukee, by far, has the most lead service lines in Wisconsin. From what I understand, data from the Natural Resources Defense Council, is Milwaukee on track for lead pipe replacement?
Yes, Milwaukee has the most lead service lines in Wisconsin, probably over 70,000 of them. They are replacing at a fast rate now. Their previous plan had taken was expected to take much longer than 10 years, but with current funding and efforts to more quickly replace them, they're now saying they can replace them in the 10-year time frame as required by this new rule.
Biden announcing Wisconsin receiving this additional $43 million for this replacement work. Is this new funding allocation helpful or enough to meet this 10-year deadline?
It will clearly not be enough money. Milwaukee will need additional funding either from the federal government, state government, or from local sources to complete this replacement in a 10-year period. I don't know exactly how much that is, but this funding won't be enough to finish it.
In other parts of the state, you talk about needing funding and processes, helping these municipalities with funding and processes to replace lead pipes. What might that look like for a community? What might that help be like?
Well, the two things I want to point out that communities need. They need help with contracting with the staff that will actually replace the pipes. So these aren't city employees. They're usually contracted teams that come to do the replacements. So they'll need help with that. They also need help with outreach and education in the community. There's a lot of coordination and work with individual homeowners and coordinating with other city departments like street departments. When you tear up the street to replace a lead service line, there's a lot to consider and to coordinate. And so those are the main things they need help with. Outreach is one of the big things. And we have stood up a outreach grant program for utilities that there's more information on our website on that. And we hope that will help with their outreach needs.
I wonder, Steve, does your office encounter misconceptions about lead line replacements?
Yes, that can be one challenge, and that's why outreach is so important. I mean, there are certain individuals, as a community starts to engage with homeowners on this, that they maybe aren't enthusiastic about replacing their lead service line because that may involve disruptions to their landscaping, or they may perceive that it will be an inconvenience. Maybe that their water might be off for a while, and that it will be a challenge. I think those are all things the utility is ready to address and to work with them on that. But sometimes it's a perception up front that's a challenge when working with homeowners.
And for those homeowners, how can residents figure out if they have lead lines that need to be replaced?
Yeah, I would encourage homeowners to contact their water utility to have them step through that process. But there are ways, visually you can look at what's the pipe material coming into your home, and then report that information to the water utility so that they know that that's a service line that they'll have to replace. So the best thing to do is to contact whoever your the water supplier is, and they'll step you through that process.
Steve, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Steve Elmore leads the DNR's Bureau of Drinking Water and Groundwater. Now we're joined by Robert Miranda, an activist and co-founder of the Get the Lead Out Coalition. That's an organization dedicated to advocating for the removal of lead pipes in Milwaukee. Robert, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you. Good morning, Kate. Pleasure to be here.
What is your reaction to the EPA's requirement to remove all lead service lines within a decade?
The EPA's requirement is fitting along the advocacy that we've been pushing for the last 10 years. And the changes that are coming down to the lead copper rule, which are governed and regulated by the Safe Water Act, are going to be released soon. And we have a concern about the changes that are coming down from the lead copper rule. We believe that not only that the push to remove the pipes is a very important issue, but we believe also that cities and municipalities, water utilities have to engage harder in public education on this topic. The people need to understand what gravity lead and water presents to the health risk of families in our community.
What outreach would have the greatest impact? How do you propose the city educate residents on this, really scary health issue?
We need to ensure that the information that is being put out by the municipalities and the water utilities are science-based, peer-reviewed research that can be easily understood by families in our communities so that they could understand the devastation that lead and water can cause to babies and infants, and in cases to adults. If the public understood how lead can impact the health of families much better, I think what we would see is a lot more cooperation in our communities from homeowners to remove these lead service lines. And it's not only the lead service lines that connect from the water main to the inside of the house to the water meter that we need to be concerned about. It's also the lead that is in the premises plumbing of the house. And homeowners need to take responsibility to remove those pipes as well. And the cities and the municipalities, the water utilities have to present that information to homeowners as well while they're educating the public on the health hazards that these pipes present to the water systems.
And on that piece of it, you've called for more help for property owners to be able to get them to remove lead pipes and plumbing from their homes. What resources do you think are lacking for property owners?
I think that property owners are lacking the kind of incentives that would move them to do that, tax abatements, some kind of loan program, low interest rate, low programs. A lot more of this has to be put out there for homeowners to see that there are options for them to engage in removing these lead premises plumbing.
Your organization is demanding community oversight of lead removal in Milwaukee. How do you want the community to oversee and really engage on this issue in lead pipe removal efforts?
I think that what we need is for the city of Milwaukee, for example, needs to invite organizations like ours that are not partnered with the city, but have a more independent voice to relay to the city the real issues that need to be addressed so that the city has a very clear understanding of how to address this and incorporate it in any plan that the city is going to be putting together to remove this hazard from our community. And to do that, we need to get at the table. These community groups that are not normally invited to meetings or normally invited to participate in discussions of this nature need to be invited, because they are the ones that are in the trenches and who are speaking to families and can come up and support whatever the city is trying to do to resolve this matter. They have the information, they have the streets, they have the knowledge from the families, they talk to families, they need to be at the table.
Robert, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for sharing.
Thank you for inviting me.
Robert Miranda is an activist and co-founder of the Get the Lead Out Coalition. That is an organization advocating for the removal of lead pipes in Milwaukee. And earlier, we were joined by Steve Elmore, director of the Bureau of Drinking Water and Groundwater at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, meet three women who lost their voting rights after felony convictions and find out why those rights take a long time to get restored, even after being released from prison.
If you think about it, part of being a citizen is your right to vote. And so the message that I was receiving was that I was less than.
That's next here on WPR News. This is Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A handful of races will decide control of the U.S. Senate in November, including Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin's reelection campaign.
Baldwin has been an outlier who outperforms other members of her party in Republican counties. And in nearly four decades in politics, she's never lost. But as Anya Van Wagtendonk reports this year, that winning streak is being tested.
It's early on a sunny Saturday in late September, and a few dozen people are gathered in a strip mall storefront in Madison. They're getting ready to knock on doors to make sure that voters in stalwart blue Dane County turn out and vote for Democrats in November.
This one has 31 doors.
Okay.
And if you want to take that one, that's turf two, we'll have you sign out.
At the top of their priority list is drumming up support for the reelection campaign of Senator Tammy Baldwin. Nationally, Democrats must retain her battleground seat to hold on to the U.S. Senate. When Baldwin herself makes an appearance, this crowd is thrilled.
Tammy's here.
That event was the start of a packed day of campaigning for the senator, who is vying for her third term. She's facing Eric Hovde, a Republican businessman, in a race that is drawing national attention and massive spending. Baldwin is a different kind of Democrat. Where her party has lost traction in rural Wisconsin, she's held on. She attributes that success to her simple approach to campaigning and to listening to her constituents.
That's the secret sauce. Travel everywhere, show up, and be responsive to people's challenges and concerns.
Baldwin won her last Senate race 6 years ago by 11 points, a landslide by Wisconsin standards. But there are signs that the race this time around is a lot closer. Analysts at the Cook Political Report recently determined that the race is a toss-up. Havdi has attacked her decades-long career in politics, describing her as a liberal Washington insider.
Career politicians like Biden and Baldwin just don't get it. They're making things harder for folks here in Wisconsin.
And he's aligned with Trump. Voters tend to be more partisan in a presidential year. That could affect Baldwin's ability to speak to voters beyond the Democratic base, says Charles Franklin, who runs the Marquette Law School poll. He says Baldwin tends to pull in more independent voters, but partisan voting is entrenched.
And within elections, we see those lines harden month to month as the election approaches.
That's why Baldwin is crisscrossing the state, looking for votes in more than just Democratic strongholds. After starting her morning in Madison, it was off to Richland Center, a community of about 5,000 people. Trump won the surrounding Richland County twice. So did Baldwin. There, she's joined by Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro in front of the County Democratic Party office. Across the street stands an enormous Trump yard sign. Shapiro said that sign is why Baldwin needed to be there.
Senator Baldwin and I show up in communities like this, and we treat voters with respect, no matter what signs might be on a neighbor's lawn or what past election results have shown.
Baldwin has been a progressive champion, supporting same-sex marriage rights and Obamacare, but she's also fought for local manufacturing and agriculture, key issues in this part of the state. Earlier this month, she became the first statewide Democrat in more than 20 years to be endorsed by the Wisconsin Farm Bureau Federation. Baldwin says she's earned support from people she calls Trump Tammy voters.
They see that I've showed up, I've listened, that I've taken their fight to Washington, and I produce results.
So Baldwin continues her breakneck campaigning. After Richland Center, there was a picnic in Dodgeville. The week after, she hit 8 counties in 5 days. Baldwin says that approach of meeting people where they're at is the key to breaking through the noise. For Wisconsin Public Radio, I'm Anya Van Wagtendonk.
Wisconsin Public Radio will air a profile of Republican U.S. Senate challenger Eric Hovde tomorrow, and you can read more at WPR.org.
Just about 5 million people are eligible to vote here in Wisconsin, but the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reports that more than 60,000 people in the state have lost their right to vote after being convicted of a felony. And that can last long after they're released from incarceration.
People who have lost their right to vote can usually have their voting rights restored after they've fulfilled other requirements of their sentence. It's called getting off paper.
Last week, I talked to 3 Wisconsin residents who lost their voting rights and then had them restored to learn how the loss of that right changed their perspective about voting and being a citizen. Kelly Mahoney is an administrative assistant for Expo of Wisconsin, which works to end mass incarceration and restore formerly incarcerated people to full participation in the life of their communities. She lives in Eau Claire. Peggy West Schroeder works for St. Vincent de Paul's reentry program in Milwaukee. And Nikki Walsh is a peer support mentor for We Adapt in Eau Claire. Kelly, let's start with you. What happens to a person's voting rights when they're convicted of a felony here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so their voting rights are taken away, and the person is not allowed to vote until they complete their extended supervision or probation.
And that's a really important point, Kelly, right? People might think, okay, somebody gets out of prison, they're done serving their sentence, they get to vote. That's not how it works, though, right?
Right. And you would think, as they are, you know, members of society, they are in society paying taxes. But yes, they do not have that right.
I want to ask each of you about your personal experiences and what it was like for you to lose your voting rights. And Peggy, let's start with you.
I'm kind of a political nerd. I really love all of that stuff. So for me, that really was my punishment, was not being able to vote. You know, I didn't mind checking in with the probation agent, paying the fees, whatever. That I was fine with all of that. But it really did hurt me that I had to, you know, sit out of the governor's election. And thankfully got my rights restored right before the 2020 presidential election. But it was pretty difficult to not be able to vote.
And Nikki, your story, I understand you weren't as big a political nerd as Peggy was, but what did it mean to you to lose that right to vote, and what did it make you think about that right?
growing up, I never really got into politics or voting. And when I became a felon, I lost my voting rights. And I really started to see the power that the vote has, you know. I started working with Expo, and I started to see the how hard other people were trying to fight to get their voting rights back.
And Nikki, when you got those voting rights restored after you'd completed all the terms of your sentence, what did it mean to you when you were able to step into that voting booth for the first time?
It was exciting. My heart was pumping. Like, I never thought that voting would be something that I got excited about, but it was. It was so thrilling, and I was just happy to know, like, that my vote mattered, you know?
And then, Kelly, can you share your story? What did politics mean to you before you lost your voting rights?
So voting was very much like a staple in our household home growing up. I would go with my parents to the voting booth. It was extremely important, and it meant a lot to me. And so for me not to be able to do that with my daughter was very difficult for me. Not being able to vote on referendums for her school was also very difficult for me. It meant so much to me being able to have it and then losing it. It's just like you feel less of a citizen, because if you think about it, part of being a citizen is your right to vote. And so the message that I was receiving was that I was less than.
Peggy, I understand that when you were still on paper, still completing those terms of your sentence, you couldn't vote, but you found other ways to get politically involved. What kind of things did you do?
The only thing you can't do is you can't circulate nomination papers for a candidate, because you have to be eligible to vote to be able to do that. And you can't actually, you know, go in and vote. So everything else you're able to do. So I did doors for Governor Evers in the snow and rain and everything else. I volunteered for making phone calls. And then as Expo, we developed a curriculum. It's called Voting with Conviction. And then we explained that to other people that didn't have the right to vote either. Like, you can still, like, Kelly can still go fill her van up with people and take them to vote on election day. And while she's driving them there, talk to them about her situation and what she would like to see changed and the candidates she thinks will do that for her. So there's still a lot of ways to get involved, even though you can't physically fill out a ballot.
Nikki, there are a lot of challenges when people are done being incarcerated, trying to re-enter society. Does it feel like because you don't get that voting right when you're done serving the incarceration part of a sentence, that's a roadblock, an obstacle to feeling like you are back involved in society?
When you get out from doing your time and you're still on supervision, you do feel like less than. It is a roadblock, because there's so many things that you can't do when without your vote.
And Kelly, a concern here is what can happen if someone thinks they're off paper, but they're not technically yet, and then they try to vote.
Yes. So I actually worked with an individual that it was kind of threatened that she would get a felony, because she actually did have her right to vote. But if you don't, then that can also have the consequence of getting another felony if you do try to.
Peggy, I think all three of you actually are trying to make the case that something should change and make it easier and faster for people to get those voting rights back. Peggy, what would you like to see change?
Well, I would like to see Governor Evers use his executive authority and give people in the state of Wisconsin who are on felony probation parole the right to vote. You know, we were raised, being raised in America, going to school here, we all learned that our forefathers believed in no taxation without representation. And that I feel very strongly about that too. You're going to make decisions for me, and you're going to tell me how to spend, you're going to spend my tax dollars, and you're going to tell me what's best for my children, but I'm not going to have a say. And that just feels wrong all the way across the board. Voting is a right. And I believe that the Fourth Amendment says, like, our forefathers also believe that you should never lose your right to vote. So I would like to see some swift action taken so that people have the right to vote. And that's approximately like 66,000 people in the state of Wisconsin it's 44,000 because it's everybody who's on probation parole in this felony probation parole in the state of Wisconsin. The 60 is if we said let's let people in prison vote, which other states do.
We're talking about voting rights and how they can be lost and regained here in Wisconsin, especially after a felony conviction. With us, three Wisconsin residents who have lost their voting privileges for a while before having them restored. Peggy West Schroeder, Nikki Walsh, and Kelly Mahoney are with us. Kelly, as you advocate for these kind of changes, do you get a sense that the public at large, and especially state lawmakers, are interested, that there's starting to be some concern about how long people with that felony sentence can't vote after they're released from incarceration?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And I like to include my story of when I did get my voting rights back and being able to bring my daughter into that voting booth and hearing her as a 9-year-old talking about candidates and saying how she wants to be socially connected to candidates. And then I reach out to candidates and I speak on this and her experience. And I think a lot of people are seeing that it's not just affecting the individual with a felony. It's also affecting future generations as well.
Right.
Peggy, did you want to add to that? I think I heard you nodding along there.
Yep. Nodding out loud to Kelly. I'm her number one fan. She just nailed it. Wisdom has a project where they do voter engagement while people are in prison. And the purpose of that is because if you have whoever the head of your household is, just like Kelly was saying, and I had very similar experience growing up. My dad was in a union. We were diehard voters. And from the time I was old enough to walk by myself, you know, my parents took me to vote with them. And that's how you create avid voters. And so we want for people, even if they're disenfranchised, to let their families know this is super important and you need to vote. And I think that we're conditioned. I'm a person of color, and I know that especially in our communities, we're conditioned to believe that our vote doesn't matter. And the reason is because people want us to believe that. They want to suppress voting in these areas. And by saying, no, you can't vote because you are currently on probation or parole or because you are in prison, those are just ways of suppressing the vote and keeping communities of color from stepping up and people running for office and really creating generational voting, which is really what my goal in life is, at least within my own family is. I always call my kids, did you vote? Did you vote? And while I was not able to vote, my kids really stepped up and they voted each and every single time and I would go with them.
I want to ask each of you, because you've all been through this yourselves and you now all work to help others, to advocate for other people who've been through the criminal justice system. Peggy, let's start with you. What made you want to do that work to help other people who've gone through what you've gone through?
For me, it's because incarceration has been generational in my family. I was born while my mom was incarcerated and then ended up in just a series of systems. And although I can look back and say that the mistakes that I've made that led to me becoming a person living with a felony conviction were my mistakes, I still know that there's a lot of stigma attached to being a person living with a felony conviction. I would love for us to live in a society where prison wasn't the first answer, it was the last answer. And the way that that happens is through who we elect and the laws that those individuals then make.
And Nikki, you've gone on to be, among other things, a peer support mentor with We Adapt. What led you to want to give back to other people in that situation?
Well, I think just living through that situation was one of the hardest things I've ever had to do. When I got out, I didn't realize how hard it would be to find a job, to find a place to live, to even just like reconnect into the community. I wasn't even allowed to go on field trips with my children and, you know, until I was like 3 years after my last conviction. People don't realize how hard it really is. And so when you have somebody walking beside you that has been through it, it increases their chances of making it substantially.
And finally, Kelly, your story going on to work now for EXPO, which I think stands for Ex-Prisoners Organizing. Correct me if I'm wrong. What led you to want to do this kind of work?
Based on my own experience with incarceration and mental health growing up, and then experiencing the collateral consequences of coming back into society and what that felt like, what that meant, how I was able to show up for my daughter in spaces like Nikki was talking about and not able to, I just think that it can be really difficult just reentering and then having all these other things piled on top of you, that we should have these rights back.
And we'll leave it there. Kelly, thanks for joining us today. Peggy, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having us.
And Nikki, thanks for taking the time.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us.
Kelly Mahoney is an administrative assistant for EXPO of Wisconsin. Peggy West Schroeder works for St. Vincent de Paul's reentry program in Milwaukee. And Nikki Walsh is a peer support mentor and recovery coach. All three of them lost their voting rights because of felony convictions and had them restored after their post-incarceration sentences were completed.
Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, a retired veterinarian in Port Washington has been helping second graders with their literacy skills for years, and they urged her to write a story just like they did.
And then one of them said, I think you should turn this into a book so other kids can read it.
The author of Niles the Cat is on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Tyler Ditter with a story about holding on to family.
When Alexandra Rosas of Cedarburg was growing up, her mother Leonore worked three jobs to provide for her six children. Rosas wished that she could see her more. In her mother's final months in hospice, Rosas finally got her wish for them to spend time together. But her mom had a wish too. And Rosas had to find the courage to respect that wish. The following story was told at the Moth during an open mic story slam in Madison, where the theme of the night was fish out of water. Here's Alexandra Rosas live at the Moth.
Did you forget she's Colombian? That's the answer my kids give to everything that I do. Now, growing up Colombian, my mother was an immigrant. She had six children. She was a single mother. She worked three jobs to give us everything. But because of that, she was hardly home, and I missed her, and I wanted her, and I wished for her, but she was working. My mother is in hospice because her kidneys are failing. The doctor says that maybe we'll have her for three more months, maybe six. But he forgets she's Colombian, too. So 18 months later, we are at Lake Michigan sitting on the bluff. I take my mother to these places, and we're enjoying our days together. And on this last day, I take her over to the wishing fountain in front of hospice, and I hand her some coins, and she throws her coins in the fountain, and she shouts, Hawaii! So I take my coin and I say, Hawaii, just in case. I have not had a chance to be with her my entire life, and I have her. And I don't even need to make any more wishes. I have my wish. I've got her. So I take her back up to her room, and she is doing so good that I decide tomorrow we can have another big day. And I tell her I'll be back in the morning. 9 o'clock, be ready. At 8:20, my phone rings. And it's the hospice center. The nurse says, your mother's sick, you have to come. So I rush over, I go in her room, the nurse says, your mother's kidneys are done. We need to start the comfort procedure. Now, months ago, my mother has signed these forms asking for a comfort procedure, meaning when things end, there is to be no hospital, and we just let things go. But she signed those papers when she used to be sick, and she's not sick anymore. We were just at the lake, and we're going to go shopping today. I step in between the nurse and my mother, and in our secret language, Spanish, tell her you want the hospital. Tell her you changed your mind. My mother grunts, hospital. I say to the nurse, you heard that? She wants to go to the hospital. The nurse says, you can't. This is her wish. And I know I was only supposed to have my mother for 6 months, but I have her for 18, and it has made me greedy, and I am ready to beg, borrow, and steal for one more minute with her. But I turn, and in English this time, I say, it's okay. You can go. I ask the nurse how long my mother will have after the morphine starts. She says 2 days. 6 days later, my mother is still with us because why does everyone keep forgetting we're Colombian? When she passes away, I'm there. And I want to say something, but I become a little four-year-old, and I'm calling her back, Mama, Mama. The nurse puts her hand on my arm, and she says, just think of the life you gave her, that she found it so hard to leave. Thank you.
That was Alexandra Rosas from Cedarburg at an open mic Moth Story Slam in Madison. You can hear the full story and find more information at wisconsinlife.org. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Tyler Ditter.
You're listening to Wisconsin Today.
A small animal veterinarian in Wisconsin is spending her retirement in the classroom, helping to teach Port Washington second graders how to read and write. Thanks to her students, she was inspired to write a children's book.
It's called Niles the Cat, a Rescue Story. It focuses on the pet adoption process, and it includes lessons about love and friendship.
Joining us now to talk about her book and efforts to support literacy is Dr. Sue Krusky. Dr. Krusky, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Well, thank you so much. I love this opportunity. This is my first time being interviewed on the radio. It's awesome.
Awesome. How did this opportunity come about to help teach literacy skills to second graders?
Oh, it's kind of a long story. I practiced for 35 years and raised two daughters. When my daughters were in school, I was working part-time and had the opportunity to volunteer in the classroom and as a lunchroom lady and chaperone on trips and things like that. And so I have a friend who's a second grade teacher, and she allowed me the opportunity to come in once a week for 2 hours. And I am usually assigned a child or two children or a small group, and my job is to read with them. And then we have a snack, and then my job is to write with them. And the writing is so fun. Of course, second graders have all kinds of great ideas for stories.
I bet they do.
And at the end of this particular class, school year, they were writing chapter books. Now, second grade chapter books, the chapter is about a page long or maybe a couple paragraphs long. The idea was multiple chapters. And I was working with some children who were writing about a chapter book about their pets. And one of them looked at me and said, why don't you write a story? And I sort of had one rumbling around in my head anyway. So I thought, well, you know, why don't I?
I hear a friend in the background.
yes. That is
that
the subject
Niles?
Of our, Yes, that's the subject of our story.
We have a second guest here in the interview. I love it. Can you introduce us to Niles the cat, how he lands in a pet adoption center?
When my daughter originally adopted him from the shelter in Chicago, she was told that he had come into the shelter with his mother and his sister. And on more than one occasion, she had said to me, "What do you think happened to the mom and the sister?" And that it really bothered her. And as a veterinarian for 35 years, I saw hundreds and hundreds of animals that were adopted from rescues and humane societies, et cetera. And they had the same question. And it occurred to me that a lot of people don't really have the understanding of what actually happens between finding a stray, trapping a stray. Of course, sometimes bad things happen too. And this is a children's book, so I wasn't going to even touch on anything like that.
Now, Niles might have a thing or two to say about that. The mom cat, to me, says, you know, having babies is a lot of work. And as the reader, I say, you know what, I feel for you, Mom. And in that moment, it really makes me feel a lot more appreciation and sympathy for older mother cats in the adoption process and what they've gone through. Can you talk a little more about how you handled that moment?
I wanted the mother to come across as adoptable, but yet with a little bit more life experience, mm-hmm. so to speak. She is, not to give anything away here, but she's adopted with another cat, and the other cat needs her. It's so she's still a mother, but yet she's still an adoptable pet.
We're talking about a new children's book. It's called Niles the Cat, and author Sue Kresge is a retired small animal veterinarian. She volunteers in a second grade classroom in Port Washington, helping students build their literacy skills. Dr. Kresge, when you got feedback from your second graders that you work with, did you change any aspects of your story, of your book?
No, I didn't. They really liked it the way it was. That's not to say I didn't change certain aspects as I wrote it, thinking of them and thinking, well, how will they handle this or how will they handle that? I thought it was attractive to them that Niles tells the story. Second graders, you know, have lived long enough so that they have some life experience, but the fact that the cat was telling the story, I thought would appeal to a second grader. There are aspects in there that are not necessarily animal related. They're more friendship related. One of the animals in the story is an older cat that it has a little bit of disability. She has, you know, big ears and crooked legs, and yet she is loved and appreciated and actually the most knowledgeable cat that he meets. Mm-hmm. So, it was that sort of lesson that I wanted to bring across as well.
Do you have any tips, any advice to how to keep students engaged in reading?
I think kids need to read things that are interesting. There's a lot of literature out there for children. Sometimes kids need a little help with finding something that they can absorb. I think it has to be a priority at home. The teacher says, you know, read for 20 minutes at night. That needs to be a priority.
Well, you have a busy house with Niles the cat. I think there's also a dog in the mix. And there's that unsettled debate, the dog versus cat, whether a dog or cat makes a better pet. I'm wondering, do you ever weigh into that debate?
It depends on the household. we've pretty much always had dogs and cats. In fact, we had two cats. And unfortunately, one of them, the older cat in the book, is had to be euthanized. She was quite elderly. Hmm. I think it depends on the personality of the animals. Niles very much likes to be an only child as far as cats go. The dog pretty much ignores Niles, except if Niles gets into her food, or tries to sleep in her spot on the bed. those are the dog's only rules. But the dog was a, she was a handful when she was young too. So it was, you know, it's a busy household. they follow me around, and Niles still to this day can open kitchen cabinets. He can take the screens out of the windows. He likes to go out in the garage with the door closed and hunt, and he occasionally will bring, you know, I have birdseed out there, so he'll occasionally bring some prey inside. He brought a live bird in one time and let it go.
Oh dear.
So yeah, he's still, even
that'll make a cat
seven,
perk up.
He's a very busy animal. Yes. Yeah. He has a lot of personality, and that's what made the story easy to write.
Dr. Kresge, before we have to let you go, did writing this children's book teach you anything about yourself?
I feel like at my age, retirement age, that life is a lot less about accumulating things and more about accumulating experiences. And my husband and I love to travel. Those are wonderful experiences. But writing this book, getting it published, even just dealing with a publisher, and because my input was asked for a number of times, even just having this experience, it was of course a learning experience, and it was a very positive experience. It's I would encourage anybody to try it. It kind of teaches you have skills that you never really kind of knew you knew.
Definitely outside the bounds of what a typical small animal veterinarian would be doing.
Right. Well, right. Although, you know, education is one of the main things that we do. We educate people all the time about behavior and diseases and medications and things like that. And I always particularly loved when families would bring the kids in and they'd ask questions, and I'd hand them the stethoscope and they'd listen to their dog's heart. And so, you know, that part was always sort of at the forefront of my thinking. But yeah, writing the book was a whole different skill set. And it's been a very enjoyable experience.
Whole different animal, as they say.
Whole different animal, right. Tongue in cheek.
Tongue in cheek. Well, Dr. Kresge, thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about my book.
And do say hi to Niles for us.
I will. He's sitting in the chair watching me do the interview.
Very good. I think he'll have some feedback for you in just a bit.
He no doubt will. Yes, he no doubt will. Right. Well, thank you. Thank you, Kate. It was very nice to have this opportunity.
Oh, you take care.
Thank you.
Sue Kresge, retired veterinarian and author of a new children's book. It's called Niles the Cat, A Rescue Story. Dr. Kresge volunteers in a second grade classroom in Port Washington. And if you're listening, Niles, go ask for some treats. You deserve it. And stay away from those birds.
We are checking in on hurricane relief efforts from Helene and preparations for Milton making landfall, and how Wisconsinites are connected to those disasters and helping in the recovery process.
And we want to hear from you about how the hurricane devastation is affecting your family and friends. Perhaps you live in Florida for a part of the year or have loved ones in the southeastern U.S. who are dealing with the aftermath of Helene.
Share your story with us as this unfolds, and we appreciate hearing from you.
Call or text us to get in touch. It's 888-642-0232 or email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org to get in touch.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/wisconsintoday. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.